Hello, and welcome to Artistas in the Capital. My name is Norma Sorto, and I'm your host for Orla Cultura's monthly podcast, featuring interviews with Latinx artists in the Washington area. The definitions of the word erase range from tangible to abstract, but there is something they all share, the idea of removal. A New York Times article about erasure details how some groups of people, typically women, minorities, and the poor, tend to be classified as inconvenient and are often dismissed. There are many types and forms of erasure. For example, back in the 1980s, a coffee house where Black LGBTQ youth gathered closed down to make way for a newer, more expensive neighborhood in Washington, D.C. Another example is when the Texas Board of Education omitted mentions of Jim Crow laws in American history textbooks in 2015. Our guest this episode grew up in South Bronx, New York, during a time he describes as burnt. Samuel Miranda, also known as Sammy, is working to keep the memory of his community alive. A teacher, poet, and visual artist, Sammy receives inspiration from his everyday life, including his DC high school students, neighbors, and family members. Describing his poems more as stories about people, Sammy uses all methods from photographs to conversations. He is the author of the book Protection from Erasure, and his artwork has been included in the Smithsonian's Molina Family Latino Gallery. Here's our interview with Sammy, conducted by Spell participants Jocelyn Samarón, Evelyn Margarito Casas, Kyla Floyd, and Ramona Santana back in February of 2023.
What was your journey going into poetry, and what inspired you to become a poet?
My first poem was probably a crappy poem for like my high school yearbook, which is in the high school yearbook, and I can't stand looking at it. But my journey into poetry didn't start there. That was just kind of like, you know, I was writing love poems to girls and like they still turned me down and it was all right. You know what I mean? But I think what it was like, I'm a teacher. This is my 30th year teaching, and I was teaching elementary my first 4 years, and then I jumped up to high school. I started teaching ninth graders. I didn't know what I was doing at all. I was like, okay, let me try to teach them something that I like. I like to read poetry. So I'm going to teach them poetry and literature, and I want to focus on Latino writers and Black writers, all that stuff. But it turns out that they were like, what are you writing? And I was like, no, this is about you all writing, you all developing your voices. And they were like, no, if you ain't writing, we ain't writing. So I was like, okay, then we'll write together. And that's where the journey started. But that led to like me reading at my first open mic with my students. Me reading on stage for the first time with my students. It was kind of this thing where as they were writing, I was like, oh, you guys need to share your stuff out. This is really great. I want you guys to like let your voices be heard somewhere else, not just here in the classroom. So we all went to an open mic on U Street. There were like 20 of us. It used to be a place called Mangoes that held an open mic. So we go in, we all sit down. And like this woman, Toni Asante Lightfoot, she comes around and she's the host and she's like, oh, great. You all are going to read. And all the kids look at me. So I'm like, all right, if I read, all of y'all have to read, period. So we all signed up on the list and we all read poems that night. But when they finished reading, when the kids got off the stage and sat back at the table, all the poets who were in the audience who had been going there regularly came over to the table and were like talking to these 14 and 15 year olds, not as other kids, but as poets. They were having conversations with these 14 and 15 year olds about their writing right there in the open mic. Like, yo, why did you use that line? Oh, that really sounded great. They were having these conversations. And so not only was I now like inspired to write, but I was inspired to be part of this writers community that saw young people as writers in and of themselves. Not people to be taught, but people working on craft. who could learn alongside you. So that was 1996 when that journey started. I always say, if you can't see the beauty in the writing that young people are doing, then you don't know what beauty is. For me, a lot of the writing that teens do is a lot more honest, a lot more open, and a lot more interesting to read. Like when y'all try to write love poems, that's something else. I don't want to read your love poems. But when teenagers actually sit and start analyzing the world in their writing, there's nothing like it. I have a poet friend of mine who also used to teach high schoolers. And when they wrote a line that was really good, he'd go behind them and put a little like finger pistol in their back and be like, I'm jacking that line from you. It was so powerful that he's just like, yo, this is what I want to do. This is how I want to write. You know, I learn from my students. And if I can't see that as a possibility, then I shouldn't be teaching.
Do you think that taking the time to observe others helped you become the artist you are today?
I write poems, but they're usually stories in some way. I write about people. So my grandfather, when I was in college and afterwards, I would go home and I'd be like, Abuelo, tell me about when you were a kid, when you were in the war, when you first came to New York. And he'd look at me and go, ¿Pa qué? No importa. It doesn't matter. And I look at him and I'm like, what? I'm like, all right. And then he dies, right? And they start emptying out his closets. And this man has like all these pictures from like World War II. He has the letters my grandmother wrote to him while he was stationed in Panama that go from like, don't write me with intentions, I got a man, to like, I can't wait to be in New York City to marry you. Oh my God. I didn't even know that woman because my grandma was kind of mean, but in these letters, she was not. But he had all these things, including this certificate that he had to get in New York in the early 60s to let him vote. So when all the Puerto Ricans were coming to New York and all the black folk were coming from the South, New York City put into place this thing where you actually had to go take a test to prove that you were literate in order to vote in New York City. This was not Mississippi. This was not like the South. This was New York. So he actually still had the certificate that he got, and he voted religiously, like every year. So when I think about it, all my poems are conversations. They're conversations with my grandfather that I never physically had with him, but I had with what he left me. They're conversations with like my friend who's a barcero who came from Cuba on a raft and like spent 4 days on the open ocean. They're conversations with the bass player that I perform with who grew up in Mount Pleasant and like had a life that was like crazy. So those are all poems now. You see what I'm saying? And I take observation not just as being what you see, but what you hear. So it's like, if y'all still got your people around who are older, who have the history, sit down with them, record them, capture their stories, because eventually they're not going to be around. You know, and you have to make those stories up based on the pictures and the letters and everything else that they left behind. So yeah, observation is everything, because I'm also a visual artist. So I take a lot of these photos and I turn those into poems as well.
What has been the most challenging part about being an artist?
Finding the next body of work. So I work in like chunks, right? Like I did a whole thing on my grandfather. I did a whole bunch of poems on like migration and immigration and a whole bunch of paintings and embroidery and all these other things that I've been creating, but the next step is always what you're looking for. I'm working all the time, but is this what I really want to be working on? Or do I need to work on something else? Okay, I'm working on this right now. Do I need to continue doing that? That kind of stuff is like what's difficult. It's just you want to be producing all the time, but I also have a full-time job. I also have a family. I also manage an arts nonprofit in Brooklyn. You know, so you've got all these things. And I'm a poet and I'm a visual artist. And I'm like also part of a film about the Mount Pleasant uprisings. So these are all things that kind of get your time. And then you got to figure out like, how do you produce the work you really want to do while still trying to make sure you meet all your responsibilities everywhere else? So I'm just going to keep working at it and figuring it out.
How does it feel to be part of the first artworks to be part of the new Latino Smithsonian Museum?
It felt good. Until I actually saw it in the museum, I was just kind of like, I got a piece, it might be there, you know. But it feels good to like also know that representation is occurring in a way that includes DC. Because oftentimes a national art scene forgets the local. Like if you look at the exhibit, they actually have a number of DC references. So they talk about this woman, Casilda Luna, who's like an Afro-Dominican woman who came to DC probably in the 50s and has been here ever since doing work. Actually, I was just at an event that was like honoring Afro-Latinos in the district, and she was in the audience. They tell stories about her, like she slapped a council member once because he promised an organization that worked with Latino communities money, and then he took it back. Basically, she was like, where's my money? And he's like, no, I don't. And she slapped him. But she also came in an era where segregation was pretty heavy, right? So she tells a story of like, she went to look for an apartment, and the guy who managed the apartment was like, this is a white building. And she looked at him and said, I don't know what you're talking about because that brick looks red to me. So she was like putting him in his place. This lady took no junk from nobody. And she did a lot of work in the community around housing. So that woman is in that exhibit. There's a zine that's out. It's called the Horchata Zine. That's done by these young Central American women. That's also part of the exhibit. And they're like based out of here. So there was a lot done in that gallery space, not just to like look at the history of Latinos throughout the country, but also to put a little bit of a focus on like Latinos who are here in the district, which was super like cool to see. Cause again, they often disappear us, especially if you're thinking about the Afro-Latino presence. They disappear that even more. So it felt good because of that.
How do you think growing up in the Bronx has affected the way you saw and felt about poetry?
Hip hop. I mean, I grew up in the Bronx in the 70s, 80s, early 90s, right? I came to DC in 88 and then moved, like not university moved, but actually work moved in 92. I always tell folks, you don't understand what you live through until you see it on TV. So I grew up in a Bronx that had been burnt down. My father had a church. He was a Pentecostal minister. He had a church that he was a pastor of on Kelly Street. Next door to the church was an abandoned building. On the other side of the church was an empty lot. Behind the church was an empty lot that ran a whole block. Next to the empty lot that was right by the church was one house, and then the rest of the block was an empty lot. Across the street was an empty lot and three buildings, and then another church. So there were places where I could walk and see for blocks without any buildings. So like a whole block just torn down with one building left standing. I used to walk to the train because I took the train to go to high school. And I would see the elevated train from a distance, and I would race the train because I could see it from so far away that if I ran fast enough, and I could run then, it was like I could beat the train to the train station because I could see it from so far away. So I think that also, like the visual harshness of a place mixed with also the beauty of a place that's in people, but also like the fear in many cases, right? I mean, I was walking down the street one day with my brother, and I hear somebody yell, yo, those two, we gonna rob them. And then my brother turned around, and he looked at them, and they were like, oh, no, that's Louis. Just let him be. But had it not been for that, we would either been fighting or running. One of the two. I got robbed in a classroom. These kinds of things affect how you see the world, right? So growing up in the Bronx was a mixture of like this beautiful independence, because you had all these things happening. I would jump on the subway and I would ride the subway because that was my favorite place. I would like walk for miles and just like chill, because I also was a very solitary person. I was a loner when I was a kid. So I didn't hang out with nobody. I cut a lot of class by myself and just walked. And I think that's what made me an observer growing up that way, because I think for us in the city at that time, you protected yourself in a couple of ways. You surrounded yourself with people who could throw down. You figured out how to throw down, or you disappeared. And I chose to disappear. So people saw me, but they didn't really see me. So that made me able in many ways to see things that other people weren't taking account of. When I was in college, I worked for the library in the photography department. And the guy said, here's a camera, here's a film, go take pictures. So I would go back home and I would walk around and take pictures of the things I saw. And later those also became poems. So I think it affected me in that it made me an observer, because it made me need to hide myself in many ways. And because of that disappearing, I was able then to like see some things that other people might not have noticed.
I love that. Like the way you just see things that even though you may be behind things and people may not see you, you definitely do understand things in a sense of perspective. And I wanted to ask, why do you feel like your poetry connects more to that type of art rather than yourself or maybe what you dealt with in the Bronx?
I always tell folks I wouldn't be a teacher, an artist, or a poet in any other city, because DC is a small town masquerading as a big city. There was a point I had a friend of mine come from Texas, and I'm walking with him through Columbia Heights because I was living in Columbia Heights at that point. I'm stopping, I'm dapping a kid up, I'm saying what's up to somebody else. I'm like, you know, run into somebody down the street. I stop for a coffee. They're like, hey, what's up? And he's like, what the hell? You the mayor? And I'm like, no, I live here. So I interact with people here. Like, this is my community. When we first moved in, there was a Puerto Rican family living around the corner that'd been living there since 1965. The guy next door to us, Mr. Smith, is like, in his 90s right now, and he's just like, hey, how's it going? You know, you're the young one, so you gotta like shovel the snow, you know, that kind of stuff. But it's just like, you know who lives in your community. You interact with the people in that community. And that's the same in the arts community here. The artists I know are collaborative. They work with each other. They offer each other opportunities. So I might go, because I'm in Brookland at the American Poetry Museum that's right there by the metro entrance where that Arts Walk sign is. I'm there every Saturday and every Friday evening, pretty much. We have events there and we have poetry readings. Folks come in and they sit down and they collage, or they read a poem, or they write a poem, or they share a poem with each other. So it's kind of like this thing where you've created this space where people can have a conversation about art that's not pretentious, that's not like stabbing you in the back, kind of like, I'm going to figure out how to do this, but you can't have any of it. It's nothing like that. It's a community of artists that support each other and who don't sound alike. So in some cities, you listen to poems and poets, and they have the same rhythm. In D.C., everybody got a different sound. Because we're not looking to create a school of poetry. We're looking to create poets who understand their own voice and who write in their own voice.
How did this book, Protection from Erasure, come about, and what was the inspiration for these particular poems?
That book, just like my second book, are all like 25 years in the making. There's poems in Protection from Erasure that I wrote in 96. in 97, and that I've been working on since then. And there's poems in the book that I wrote 4 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago. What it is a testament to is that shit don't change. The issues that we were dealing with in 96, we're still dealing with today. For me, Perception from Erasure is a book where I started looking through my work and finding this thread that really was about maintaining the stories of other folks alive. And not just the stories, but also making sure that the issues that we kind of tend to disregard at times are present constantly. That you're just like, here, listen to this. Listen to it again. Listen to it one more time. Because if you stop listening, then you forget. And if you forget, it erases from your memory. And that also, I think, comes from like watching my grandfather go through dementia. So where little bits of his memory just kept falling away. So it's also thinking about like, how do you capture moments in time as well as ideas so that they keep a life? I think it's in Mayan culture, they say that you die three times. The first time is when your breath leaves your body. The second time is when your body becomes dirt. But your final death is when nobody remembers you. So what I'm hoping to do with my work is to keep folks alive for as long as possible, to keep ideas alive as long as possible, to keep conversations going and alive for as long as possible.
What was the process of finding a publisher and working with your editor to publish the book? And after going through this process, what insights or advice would you give to other poets looking to publish their work?
Well, I've been lucky. Part of that is my community. So this book, as well as my first book, happened because of Lisa Pegram. Lisa Pegram is a native Washingtonian who's also a poet. And my first book, she was like, Sammy, man, you should send this to so-and-so. He'll read it because I told him to read it. And I'm like, okay. So I just said yes. And I sent Enzo my manuscript and Central Square Press published it. This book, Lisa calls me up. She's like, I'm doing acquisitions for this publishing house. I want to acquire your book. Can I have it? I'm like, yeah. And then my second book was somebody who had published me prior in an anthology and then was like, let's do your book. And I was like, okay. And it turns out actually that the guy who published my second book, I've known him for 10 years at the point that we found this out. He's my wife's nephew from her birth parents, and we didn't know. So this is how this community gets crazy sometimes, right? But I mean, my advice would be write and keep on writing and share your work with people. Let other people read it because you never know who's going to have a connection where. Even if you like, I'm not sure about this, read it to somebody. You know, read it to a friend, read it to a teacher, read it to another writer. Because again, you never know who they might be connected to. I always tell students, treat your teachers right, because you really don't know who they know. And if that person comes asking about you, what are they going to say about you? I'm not saying take crap either, because you shouldn't take crap from teachers any more than you should take crap from anybody else. But be respectful of those folks who are trying to do right by you. But write and share and read other people. Because the more you read, the more you're studying the craft, and you got to study the craft. In D.C., the biggest thing was like, I couldn't get into a car with a bunch of poets if I wasn't reading. Because they'd be like, yo, what you reading right now, man? Like, what you got to recommend? I'm reading this and this and this and that and that and this one here. I'm reading that too. And I just read this one. You should read it. What are you reading? And if you didn't have nothing to say, they'd be like, hey, man, that you ain't writing, because they want you to study. You need to study craft. So if you're going to write, if you want your work published eventually, you read, you write, you share. And then if you get to that point, you start submitting and you submit everywhere. And don't worry about rejection, because it's going to come and it's okay, because the people who need to read your work will read your work.
Thank you, Sammy, for your interview with Hola Cultura. Join us next month when we speak with uncategorized queer Latinx artist Stephanie Mercedes. For updates on episodes and Latinx events in the DC area, follow us on Instagram at @olocoturaDC. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Artistas in the Capital. To get involved in Latinx arts, culture, and humanities in DC, sign up to join our SPOL program and visit olocotura.com.